Welcome to another episode of the Growth Focus Podcast, where we bring tech leaders from all around the world to share their time, their insights, and their expertise with you and I to help us grow our businesses within the tech sector. My name is Gary Lafter, your host and founder of the Growth Focus Partnerships, where we take experts in tech, elevate them towards being the authorities in their field so that their conversations can turn into clients and their insights can turn into pipeline. I'm extremely excited to have this episode's guest on. I've been waiting quite a while to actually nail him down. He's such a busy guy. And what we're going to be talking about today is three main things. And so if I was you, I'd get about a pen and paper or just lean in a little bit, because we're going to be talking about how to untangle complex tech issues without having a massive army as a team. We're also going to be talking about, you know, how do you actually grow a business on referrals alone and the challenges that come from that. And we're also going to be talking about how good thought leadership will always, always outbeat overhyped trends. So I'm really looking forward to this particular episode. So without further ado, Noah, it's an absolute pleasure to actually have you join us today. Thank you for being with us. Why don't you start by just giving us a quick introduction about who you are and what is it that you do?
Thanks for having me on. We had a conversation probably a month ago now that was just so chock full of great topics that I'm excited to see kind of like what we can cover today, what fun material we can make it through. I'm Noah Landau. My company is MacTez. I'm the founder. It's almost 30 years now since I founded it. My business partner and I have been doing technology consulting for coming up on 3 decades. We're New York City based, although we did have a brief period where we had London and San Francisco offices. As the founder, obviously, my job has changed many times over those 30 years. CEO as well right now. So a big part of what I do and what the organization does, of course, is we kind of are confronted by tricky, complicated, messy, convoluted problems and try to sort of undo the tangle, figure out how to break them up into smaller pieces, and then how to actually collaborate, usually with kind of in-house or small technical teams to sort of make these sort of overwhelming problems manageable. So we have some great projects we've done like that here.
I can't wait to dive into that because, as I said, sometimes we can overcomplicate things, or sometimes things just are complicated and we just need to break it down into bite-sized chunks and make it manageable so we can actually attack each one and get rid and eliminate that problem. So before we dive into that, let's start at the beginning. You've been around for almost 3 decades, as I said. That's very, very rare within the tech industry. Let's go right back to the beginning. What originally led you to launch or lead this type and kind of work?
That's a great question. You know, it started as I think maybe it's not so uncommon, but for me, it seemed like a curious moment. I hadn't intended to go into technology. My degree is actually in architecture. And I moved to New York City thinking I was going to do design work. I had done a bunch of design work for a German company called Meta Design in San Francisco and had like a couple of great relationships. I'd been on a bunch of portfolio reviews. And I moved to New York and had fully intended to just be doing design creative work. And I kind of fell through happen chance as a favor for someone who kind of had a technical problem and was like, hey, maybe you could solve this. And I was like, I'm not qualified. Architecture is my background, not this. And as often happens, agreed as a favor to help out for a little while. And one thing led to another. And kind of realizing at a certain point that the problems that I was being presented with as technical problems were extremely similar to the kind of design problems I'd spent years trying to figure out how to come up with good solutions for. So over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, a group of us, a group of freelance sort of consultants came together and ended up forming MacTez. The kind of projects we did, this again is the mid-1990s. So the kind of projects that a technology consultancy did in the 90s are not the same as the kind of projects that a consultancy like ours would do now. And I think that's been one of the things that's been a fascinating sort of trajectory to navigate. Is like I kind of set as a selfish personal ambition. Every half decade or so, I picked sort of like a thing that I was curious about, something that I didn't know how to do that I wanted to do somehow better than I had done before. And so each sort of half decade or so over the last 30 years, I've kind of picked a different area of focus each time. The first 5 years, I remember distinctly just reading up voraciously and meeting people for drinks to talk about like different corporate entities and accounting and bookkeeping and just did sort of a crash course on sort of trying trying to like read books and figure out how to do that kind of stuff. And then it kind of evolved over the years to different things. The most recent sort of half decade has really been about, relevant to our conversation, kind of growth and sales and marketing. And I think that's a very interesting world right now in particular, because it's a very different world now than it was 30 years ago. But there are some common themes. There are some kind of like cultural kind of core values that I think sort of carry through that you can, I can look back and see a through line that I might not have seen kind of from the other direction. So.
Well, before we actually get, you know, dive into what is it that you actually do in within that niche, because before we break into that, I think people are going to be very interested in that. As I said, what do you believe is a secret? I know what you said is every half decade. You spin it off like it's nothing. You know, it's just every 5 years I think about that, every half a decade. What do you think is the secret to longevity within the tech world? Is with things changing so fast, like you said, what it was in the 90s is not what it is today.
Yep.
Is it constant improvement? Is it looking for new opportunities? What do you think is the secret when it comes to staying the course in an ever-changing environment?
I think that's great. There's a couple of different aspects to that. I think there's sort of a little bit of a very oversimplistic, maybe slightly trite answer. But I think that the more interesting answer is really curiosity. I think one of the things that comes up a lot is, as long as the stuff you're paying attention to on a day-to-day basis is intriguing to you, is something about which you get a little bit excited, then I feel like there's this sort of like emotional lightness to your day. But if you find yourself sort of ground down and kind of like no longer enjoying what you're doing, that's bad. So I talk a lot internally to my executive team about the limiting factor for us isn't as much hours, although it often feels as an executive like you're talking about whose hours go where and what projects are kind of prioritized in what order. But really, I think it's attention. It's where and what do you have the sort of energy and focus to pay attention to? And interestingly, I think for a lot of people, I can pay attention to something I'm excited about for 10 hours straight. But if it's something that is not something I'm enjoying, a half an hour is agony. And I think that's a really crucial part of this, is sort of taking the time. This is a slightly sillier answer, is to sort of like be a little bit stubborn and pick something and just kind of like stick with it long enough so that you can really tell, is the thing I'm doing going somewhere? Because most things take a lot longer to pay out than you think they're going to when you begin them. And you think it's going to be like, oh, this will work in a month or two. And 6 months later, you're like, haven't quite launched it yet. So, you know, recognizing that in architecture, there's a truism that everything takes three times as long as you thought it was going to and costs three times as much. I think that happens a lot in tech as well. But in business, there's often this moment of like, hold on, I feel like I kind of should be getting the payout for this, but I'm not yet, but I still need to stay the course a little longer. The counterbalance to that is something I used to think about a lot when I was first getting started, is there's this idea that you can't pick like a 10-year, 20-year plan and just like start walking and expect that the plan you began with is going to make sense at the end. So there has to be some kind of mechanism in your own week, day, year, month. It could be a retreat, it could be a coach, it could be a business partner, but there has to be something somewhere in your experience that says, I'm going to be stubborn, but I'm also going to stop every once in a while and look around and be like, should I keep digging? Should I keep digging or should I stop digging? And I think if you don't have that combination of sort of a little bit of stubbornness and kind of like a built-in moment to pause and take stock, I think then you can very easily end up sort of painted into these sort of like weird corners where you look around and you're like, how did I get here and why am I here?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always find that balance of the acre of diamonds, isn't it? That
yes.
How long do you keep digging for when you could be that close or you could be that far away? And that's always finding that balance. But as you quite rightly said, it's having someone, a support system to a degree that you can probably bounce a little idea off or at least hold on to the safety rope and say, maybe it's a little bit too far, but keep that stubbornness. Absolutely love that. So let's go back to what you do. You're in a very, very unique niche. Can you give us paint us a very quick picture of what is it that your company does and who does it serve and the problem that you solve for them?
Great question. So the way I sometimes find is the sort of the, in the abstract, it's a little bit like, what does that mean? So much of tech and IT is sort of this like ephemera that when you talk about it, it's very easy to find ourselves talking about things in sort of like a self-referential or sort of like a muddy way. So I'm just going to use a couple of like real world case studies. I think that, you know, the actual physical things that happen in the world sometimes are like, oh, that's what that means. So to use two different client examples, both of which are case studies on our website because we love talking about them. One is a really interesting, really unusual park, literally an outdoor public space park called Little Island that was built and floated down on pylons and basically erected off the coast of New York City, off the Manhattan side. It's actually relatively near to the High Line. We had worked for many years with the High Line, which is a very well-known park in New York. We also still work with Domino Park and Brooklyn Bridge Park and numerous other organizations. But Little Island was extremely unusual because it was built from scratch. It was really these kind of like giant things that kind of grew up out of nothing. And so we were brought in there. A bunch of work had already been done. A lot of amazing, really great people had done a lot of thinking about technology, about life safety, about connectivity, about surveillance, about security. But there was this sort of missing piece in the middle. And we basically were brought in by some operations people we had worked very closely with before, who said, it seems like all these people are talking, but I don't actually know if they're all like, are we missing something? It seems like maybe there's something missing. And kudos to them for recognizing that there was sort of like maybe a slippage. And we started recognizing that like some of the concrete boxes that had been poured for IDFs and network racks weren't the size that the other vendors had spec'd, that the cooling didn't map, that the electricity and backup battery requirements were sort of mismatched. So a big part of what we did there was just sort of like untangle, like who has done what, what's changeable and what's not changeable. Like we're not going to re-pour the concrete, but we can identify like, does Cisco have a special piece of equipment that can work within these new revised parameters? And the answer, of course, was yes. And so a lot of our work there was sort of like untangling which things are what, which are easily solved, which are quite expensive and complicated to solve. And then unlike a lot of companies like ours, we didn't just sort of hand off the like recommendation. We actually then step in and we can actually do the implementation. Actually, we can provide team members to come in there and actually do the physical installation, have to climb up on ladders, to mount access points, to coordinate and do logistics. So our team is small. We're about 20 people, but we're multifaceted enough that we're able to come into these kind of environments and really understand the life cycle of the need, not just sort of this sort of narrow defined. And a lot of companies like ours either do very, very narrow or they do very, very broad. And we're unusual in that we can kind of do this sort of wider range, but then identify these sort of spikes where a lot more hands-on, kind of complex, particular detail work is required and has a high value and kind of step in and own that piece. Again, for a client, particularly one that's under pressure of time and often a lot of different competing restraints, it helps avoid a kind of a catch-22 where you find yourself just sort of shrugging and stuck. So Little Island is a great example. Another similar kind of need was a private company called MakerBot, now part of a larger organization called Ultimaker, which is a 3D printing, actually the kind of initial kind of pioneer of the sort of home 3D printing world. And MakerBot had been around for many years at this point and had built a legacy sort of server rack. Their staff had changed a number of times over the years, and they had sort of ended up with a bunch of people running things who didn't really quite have their kind of chops to sort of run the infrastructure that their predecessors had installed. And so things had sort of started decaying and things had fallen out of warranty and the Cisco equipment was no longer covered. And it had reached a point where it was just sort of like a little bit daunting in terms of like where to start. If you touch one thing, the whole thing falls apart like a house of cards. And so we spent about 3 years working closely with some existing in-house IT team members to train them up. We also kind of acted sort of like an interim IT department and an interim IT director. We did a lot of strategy, a lot of working on the sort of like SAP and ERP projects, a lot of the close coordination and data migrations involving Europe and GDPR. So we ended up sort of essentially doing a whole series of these special projects that wove together to get the organization from this just sort of like convoluted, messy, fragile state to like a nice, solid, clean, well-organized, documented. The visual example on our website is the network closets were like thousands and thousands of tangled wires sort of in a spaghetti. And then by the end, it was like all 1 foot jumpers that were perfectly aligned, completely labeled. And like everything had like a diagram on it that you could walk up and immediately see what was where. So.
Yeah,
similar conceptually.
Ultimately, is creating clarity from chaos, really.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
You know, there's so many founders, they just hit this kind of messy middle as they scale, as they go through it, and they just hit this, as I said, this blancmange that they just go in through, or this big bowl of spaghetti, and you know, you just go in there and you help them untangle it, and as you say, just turn that chaos into clarity. So absolutely. That being said,
and actually,
go on.
Speaking to that point, that moment of like when things got messy and when to do something about what the messiness means is, I think, a very interesting question. Because a lot of organizations, particularly organizations that are scaling, it's like an interesting question of like, do you do it now? Do you wait? Do you wish you'd done it a year ago? And we've had so many conversations internally and frankly in prospective client conversations where we're like, oh no, this is a problem that's going to be extremely complicated to fix now that you have 100 people scattered around the entire country. I really wish we could have solved this problem when you had 10 people scattered and everybody was in New York before you went hybrid. Now that everyone's hybrid, like unhooking your AD and your hybrid migration to a new IDP is like really, really quite tricky. So we joke sometimes that it's like, I wish we'd had this conversation a year ago is sort of one of these things we say a lot. But we ended up deciding to write a book basically called How to Tame the Tech Beast, which really talks about a kind of a process on how to kind of like navigate this path, how to get from this sort of like overwhelming confusion state. And part of it is, I think, how to break it up into smaller pieces. And part of it is how to think about trust and how to think about kind of allocation of energy and resources, how to determine when is the right time, not just what to do, but you might have a key piece of the puzzle that is like a really good thing to do, but your operational projections, budgets, and team are just not equipped to handle them right now. So you need to figure out like how these things get sequenced from a resource, internal culture, from your external kind of deadlines and other migrations and projects. Anyway, all that is to say, it's something we think about a lot is sort of like untangling this mess and then trying to tame this sort of like.
I really like the fact that you mentioned that earlier. You know, it's a case of educating the client, educating them as to, you know, I'm a great believer. People who watch the show who know the show, I'm a great believer in education-based marketing. Education-based onboarding, educational. But just the more you can educate that person, the more you can educate that your prospect or your client, the easier it's going to be, and the easier you brought up the word there. The most important word is trust. Trust is one of the hardest things to earn in today's world, when everybody apparently sounds the same, and we all think we're unique, but we apparently all sound the same. So that being said, that's a lovely little segue time. You mentioned, when you and I have chatted before, you mentioned the majority of your business has come from referrals. Now, that's not going to be anything new. Everybody listening here has always built their business on referrals. But we all know that's unscalable. It gets to a point where there's no more scalability in there, because you're totally reliant upon XYZ as opposed to doing something, proactively. What are you now? I know you've hit that particular plateau now. What are you doing now to become more visible to the right clients earlier in their decision making?
That's great. I think there's an interesting element where it's you mentioned earlier, but it's actually the right time, because we're often find ourselves talking to clients a little too early or a little too late. And both of those are bad, right? There's a moment in time before they've spent their budget to solve this problem. That's the point when we want to have the conversation. And if we talk to them too early before they've figured out how this is a priority and it's really something we need to do, but also if we've talked after they've spent half their budget on something that didn't work, then we're sort of a little bit stuck. So we think a lot about how do we get ourselves in front of people so that they think, right, I am having these problems right now. So part of it is, for many years, we had a very lighthearted kind of like marketing program, which was based on kind of a series we called the Museum of Yellow Objects. It was this sort of like whimsical, it was just a wall of objects that were yellow, which is our corporate color, in our conference room. And people would come to visit our office and be like, whoa, there's like hundreds of these like weird little yellow oddities from around the world. It was sort of a lovely collection. It was charming. It was quixotic and a little bit sort of lighthearted. We ended up sort of winding down that and something we used to call the summer stipend, which was a creative grant we used to give every summer. During COVID, during all the uncertainties, a bunch of those initiatives, we just sort of put them all on hold and kind of reconfigured ourselves a little bit. And now the last 5 years or so, coming out of COVID and lockdowns and frankly, a pretty dramatic set of technology changes in terms of AI and other cloud migrations, we are kind of revisiting some of those initiatives. And so some of those are, we host a in-person physical event series we call the Teta Tech, which is every other month we have basically like a fireside chat with an expert in some sort of deep technical area. And those are super fun. Those are relatively small. Those are under 30 people physically in our office. And we usually have a pretty long wait list for them. So if anyone is in New York and is curious, you can look us up and see it. It's a sign up. We often end up letting people off the wait list because there's often last minute cancellations and travel change plans. But so that's one small area where we've started doing that. We have a really wonderful office in the East Village of Manhattan in a fantastic area. It's a really lovely space. Second, over the last year or two, Jeremy and Sarah, who's two of the key members of our client services department, have started amping up the sort of what I would call like educational content. They started writing a lot more, not just about case studies and about things we've done, but sort of like trying to unpack some of the confusing concepts like DMARC and DKIM and identity and multi-factor and different kinds of multi-factor. So they've sort of settled into a pace now where they're writing a much more regular set of, I think, highly informative and highly legible articles for the blog, which also serve obviously for a newsletter. In addition, as I mentioned in passing, my business partner and I decided about a year ago to write a book, which we're, I think, very close to finishing, probably in the next couple of months, called How to Tame the Tech Beast. And it's really meant to be kind of a how-to guide or manual for maybe a CTO or a VP of IT, or maybe a CFO or COO, somebody in that position who's sort of like realizing things aren't working quite right, but isn't quite sure who and how and what kind of company to talk to. And then the last piece is we've experimented a few times with some outbound. We're doing a little bit of an outbound experiment now. We did a little bit of an email outbound experiment last year. And so it's been interesting a little bit to kind of like test our waters, engage a company to sort of like do some experimentation with. And those have been interesting. We've had some successes. I think for an organization like ours, we're the kinds of clients we work with now and have for the last 5 years tend to be a much smaller number of much larger clients. We were, when we were younger as an organization, many of our clients were 20 to 25 person creatives. And we've essentially, over the last 25 years, we've come to feel that many of those organizations are better served self-serving a lot of their technology, not relying on an organization like ours. We do still have a bunch that are very high touch, that are white glove, that we are absolutely happy to take care of because they're wonderful and have amazing missions and visions. But in many cases, organizations come to us and they're like, should I spend our money here or there? And we're like, you should probably upgrade all your equipment and go buy, you know, Dropbox and Google Workspace or Office 365. That's a better place to spend your money than on us. And so a lot of our prospective growth, a lot of our opportunities over the last 4 or 5 years have been these much bigger, you know, 1,000 headcount, 500 person headcount, have been organizations where we're really co-managing these platforms with an in-house IT department. And that's an area I'm excited about because I think it's a really fun and interesting and complicated problem to solve. There's a lot of personality involved. There's a lot of technical kind of navigation involved. And it takes a little while sometimes to establish those relationships. You're not just earning the trust of like the CTO. You really need to earn the trust of like their entire help desk as you serve as maybe the escalation point or the trainees for those people. So, but that kind of collaboration, I think, is something that our team is especially good at. You know, they really are empathetic and care about the people on the other side. And there's something wonderful about being like, you are the person who's the front lines. Like, how do we help you get better and better as the help desk person who's in-house at navigating these things? Like, I'm here, I got your back. You get stuck, you come to me, but I'm not here to take your job. I'm here to help you kind of like scale and do better and better.
Well, do you know what? Now that you've said that, I'll just listen to what you've just said there. And if you saw my eyes flickering, it's because my brain's constantly thinking about, oh, growth. How do we use that? Growth, what is better? What is that? And constantly. So, but just to dissect a little bit about what you said there, because there was an awful lot you just threw in there. And I just want to
pull it in pieces
a little bit, because there was some great insights in there with all the different things that you've trying and doing and whatnot and experimenting. So if you take all of what you just said in that little sector there, you have very long-term, high trust-based contracts. That's where you're good at. That's what you do. That's what you're known for. What do you believe is more important today to win those? Is it expertise? Is it visibility? Is it relationships? Because there are all those three things is what you just mentioned in there. If you were to scale them, expertise, visibility, and relationships, where would you put them and why?
That is a great question. So I think the relationships are something which I would give you a different answer now than I would have 15 years ago. We have some amazing relationships, but many of our relationships 20 years ago were with people who moved through organizations, but essentially are working with organizations that are not positioned to take full advantage of what we do. And so I think that one of the conundrums of the referral-based functionality is if you have a group of people who have all moved around a lot and all of them are essentially in the role that hires you, then the referral-based relationships are fantastic because, you know, person A moves to a new company and is like, oh, we need a better MSP. I'm going to hire the guys I worked with before. And that happens all the time. And that's wonderful. But that's not really the kind of work. Often our projects and our work are much more about spending 5 to 10 years helping an organization redo a set of things. And then our involvement at the end is actually quite small. Sometimes it's managing an identity management platform. And it's really like, that's it. That's all we're doing, that and a little bit of escalation at the end. And so we're not an organization where we're going to come in and just kind of like take over everything and fire your in-house people. And because of that, I feel like the relationship and the trust, of course, that's all super duper important, but it sits at sort of a different area. The technical competency, I'm not actually sure if that was the correct word. I think you used a different word, but let's say technical competency is critical, of course. But I feel like that's an area
of expertise.
There you go. Yeah. I feel like expertise is one of those things that sort of, you of course want people to trust you and believe you have it. But every problem's a little different. And so there's this interesting element of like, does the person believe that you have the right expertise to solve the problem that they have? And that of course, falls back into the relationship side. I'm sorry, you mentioned three, and I think I have an answer. Visibility. I think visibility is the area that we are the worst. And I think, you know, ultimately, it's the area that I have spent a lot of the last 6 months thinking about. It's part of the reason why we do these Tech Talk events. It's part of the reason why we're doing the book. And I think visibility is an area where it's like, it doesn't matter how good you are at what you do and how awesome the network of 1,000 or 2,000 people you know, if 90% of the people who you are, like, who are your perfect client, your ICP, if 90% of those people have no idea that you exist, then they won't come to you at the time when you're ready to help them. And so that's been a big part of my kind of thought process and, frankly, my curiosity and my interest over the last year. Has been like, what does it take to get out there? You know, shake off your dust a little bit and go out into the world and go to more events and talk to more people and kind of like think about how to tell the story to a broader, wider audience. And obviously, here being here on this conversation is one of the illustrations, I think, of why I think that matters.
Yeah, absolutely. And you nailed it on the head there earlier, Nora. It's like, you'd be very good at what you do. It doesn't matter if you're in business 5 years, 10 years, 2 decades, 3 decades. If you've been busy being busy and unseen and no visibility, you're the best kept secret. And that's been one of the biggest challenges out there. And if you're the best kept secret, you're having to build trust all over again every single time you're with a prospect. You know, and in today's age, if you're not being visible, you're not building trust. And if you're not building trust, you're struggling. You're coming from the back foot every single time. Every time you have a conversation, you're coming from the back foot. And people out here listening and watching will probably be nodding the head just like you are, Nora, and go, yeah, I totally agree with Noah. This is, we've got to get back out there. But then the next challenge will obviously come is that, yeah, when you go out back then doing events and things like that, everyone sounds the same. I was at an event last night and everyone's just roaming around saying the same old thing and no one was really standing out at all. It's kind of like still, they're doing one step, but they're not getting the benefit out of that. So yes, you've got to find different ways. And the book is a fantastic way. I'm a great believer, you know, having written 2 books already, I'm a great believer in putting your wares out there and educating the people through that. So when they are aware, and you're absolutely thinking, and this is things that most people don't think of, especially in tech. I see it all the time. They believe in this field of dreams mentality. I build it, they'll come. But we're only ever talking about 1-3% of the market at any one time. There's 97% aren't ready. They might like you, they might want you, but they're not ready at this time. And you could be quickly forgotten if you're not at the forefront. I'm so glad you use visibility as well. So that being said, what have you experimented on? I know you're doing podcasting now, you're doing these events now, you're doing the book. What do you see yourself doing in the next 12 months on top of those three things?
That's a good question. So obviously some of those are things I'm personally doing and some of those are things my team is doing. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the areas we've historically been good at is kind of keeping tabs on our prospective clients that didn't come through, the leads that didn't turn into something. And I think we've begun to realize over the last few years that as our sort of ideal clients have grown in scale, more and more of our kind of like, oh, that didn't work out, that wasn't the right time, that, you know, the 400 or 500 companies we've spoken to over the last 10 or 15 years, many of those are just not the right fit for what we're doing now. And so a big part, I think, of doing what we do now is recognizing that we kind of need a new set of outreach contacts, a new set of conversations. Obviously, kind of there's some sort of posting a little more vigorously and actively on LinkedIn, being a lot more kind of like active in that as a sort of social media proxy. Similarly, I think conversations like this, I love talking to people, particularly people like you, Gary, who are sort of fun and interesting and have sort of perspectives that I respect and that I find very sort of like enjoyable to bounce around all those different topics. I have a lot of different kinds of interests. So from a purely sort of selfish perspective, having these conversations was gratifying and fun. So you know, a big part of my job as founder, I think, is to just sort of get off my butt and just go out there and have those conversations. But the other things is our team is doing a lot more work on LinkedIn, is obviously doing a lot more on email and messaging and newsletter. So our team's sort of getting out there and talking a lot more explicitly. It's interesting to think back that the case studies, of which there's maybe a dozen or so on our website right now, as little as 5 years ago, we had no case studies. We never talked about those things. So a big part of this evolution of this time is recognizing that like no one knows you do these things unless you tell them. And it's not unusual for us to have a conversation with a client where we say, you do know we do this as well. And they're like, oh, I didn't know that. That's amazing. And that's obviously, that's an education failure on our part that like somehow this client who's known us for 10 or 15 years doesn't know we do this other thing. That's something we need to get better at. And some of that's just about the client, the technical account managers and in the QBRs and having those conversations and those communications come up so that people are kind of reminded periodically. The last piece, I think, is we've always been very conscientious about how we use other people's time, particularly on our clients and our potential clients. And so we've always been a little cautious about sort of like communicating too much. But I think a big part of the last 5 or so years is realizing that we need to be a little less sort of held back. And we just need to communicate a little bit more. If we want to get out there and we want people to like think of us, we can't send them one email. They're probably going to need to get 5, 6, 7, 8 times before they're like, oh, it's those guys again. And that's something, interestingly, that I have found myself on a number of occasions getting an inquiry and kind of being like, it's not the right time. And then 5 or 6 nudges later being like, actually, now is a good time. And so it's interesting to sort of be on the other side of that. As a founder, of course, I do get a lot of inquiries for things which are, you know, we get probably 10 outreach attempts a day to buy the company. And so that's the kind of thing where it's like, okay, those are not something we're looking for, but it is fascinating to see how frequently and how often some of that stuff happens. And I think part of what we need to do, what Jeremy and Sarah and I need to get better at, and Ben, our other team members here in client services, is more comfortable with just sort of like more communication, being out there more, following up more, checking in more, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that. It's that we know now, over years and years of research, there's the 7-touch rule. You've got to be talking to, you've got to touch them at least 7 times, or they need to at least see you at least for 7 hours in some shape or form, whether it be written, whether it be visual, whether it be audible, whether it be LinkedIn. Until they actually penny drops, or when they're absolutely ready to buy, they must have seen you at least 7 hours or 7 touches, at least 7 or 8 touches. And they haven't done that. The reverse of that is if you haven't done that, then you're not in the running when they are ready. And that is the key. That is one of those, you know, reality checks that we see more and more within the tech companies. They just think, oh, when they're ready, they'll come to me and then we'll compete. Then we'll put a thing and it'll be, but you're a nobody. You haven't built any trust. You haven't done anything yet.
And That reminds me, I like to think of, I had one of my very first conversations way, way back 30 years ago was with a salesperson, a really great sales guy who was like the softest sale ever. He was always like, what do you need? And we ended up going out and having a conversation. And I was like, you know, I'm really uncomfortable with sales. It makes me feel a little like I'm being pushy. And he's like, sales isn't making people like buy or take or do anything they don't want. It's just making it as easy as possible for them to get the things that they do want. And I remember thinking about that. That has sort of stuck with me for 30 years now. His name was Mark Mandel, great, great, great human being. And I still think of that now. It's like, you know, you just want to make sure you're not making it hard for people to get what they need from you. That's a big part of sales. And some of it is sort of recognizing what material you're delivering, how to make it coherent. We sell things that are sort of complicated and confusing and frankly, very individual. So there's an interesting process for us of like how we can't sort of like put up a one sheet. We're like, ta-da, buy this product, because what we do is more convoluted than that. It's more individual and it's more particular. So there is this element of like what our process looks like, how we get people to tell us where their pain points are and what their budgets look like. And if somebody says I have $10,000 a month or I have $100,000 a month to solve this problem, we're going to be talking about different kinds of solutions. We can probably solve them at both of those points, but we're going to solve them very, very differently. And so understanding, you know, who to talk to and what kind of vendor relationships to cultivate. I think one thing that's also a little bit of a side topic, but the constant state of change in technology over the last 30 years, but frankly, it feels like that pace has accelerated of late, has definitely made for a very interesting element where kind of the role of a technology solutions provider or a technology consultant or an MSP is different now than it was 5, 10, 15, 25 years ago. And so a big part of kind of what I think our conversations with clients are is sort of like, what is it that you actually should pay somebody to do? And whether it's us or not, like, what is it you want? Often we have conversations where someone says something like, oh, I just want to like not worry about this. And it's like, well, there's pieces of this you'll have to worry about, but we can make it easier for you to worry about the things that you understand and you like and you relate to, like maybe budgets or contracts. But somewhere in here, it's sort of understanding how to share responsibility for these things so that, you know, the person we're working with is like a classic example is a CTO who's really product focused and is like, doesn't want to be looking over their shoulder to like worry about the, identity or workstation management solutions. So they're kind of like, I don't want to think about that. And you're like, great. We need some help from you to figure out the pieces. But once we have that, we can take care of it. But we do need you to basically reconnect periodically to make sure that this is staying aligned with your strategy and your goals and your budgets and all that. So that's always an interesting conundrum of like where and how those resources are allocated best.
Yeah, absolutely. We could continue this for forever and ever. And this is why I've always enjoyed talking to you, because there's so many things that we talk about. We just bounce on every single time and we're just bringing out more and more. It's so fantastic. But time is upon us. So I have one final loaded question for you. I ask a very similar question to all my guests and stuff like that. If you wanted to impart, if you wanted one of the listeners here, one of the viewers or a founder or a leader that's actually watching or listening to this, and you wanted them to take away one piece, just one major piece of advice that's come from today's conversation, what would that piece of advice be?
I think it would probably be, again, let's assume it's sort of peers and other people in the technology space. I think it would be recognizing that sort of, generosity works to your benefit. I think it's very tempting to think that you want to hide things and protect them and things should be secret. But ultimately, none of us are really succeeding because we've got some sort of like magic secret recipe for Coca-Cola. We're succeeding because we're engaged in conversation, we're building rapport, we're navigating these sort of uncharted and sometimes partially charted territories together. And so, my one piece of advice would be, you have to sort of trust the relationships and be open and share.
No, absolutely. And I totally agree with that. And what a great piece of advice to end this great conversation. I'm sure, Noah, if you're willing, we should have part two to this, because I think this is going to be an absolute great episode with so much more to share. Thank you very much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure and an honor to have you here.
Absolutely fantastic. You have a wonderful day and a fantastic summer.
Thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for yet another episode of the Growth Focus Podcast. And if you have taken anything from Noah today, I know my brain is just spinning over loads of things that Noah has just mentioned there. If you've taken anything, make sure you like it, you put it down in the comments so other people can see what you've picked up, that might be useful to them as well. But more importantly, please share. This is a podcast for leaders. We've got loads of great leaders who are sharing their insights that could help you. So please make sure you share this episode with others so that others can grow as well. So until the next episode, please keep striving. Please be profitable, and we'll see you on the next episode. Bye-bye.